Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Oh,
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, I hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Okay. There's a little technical faux pas here. Let's see if we can get things restarted here. Today's podcast is titled ANC Commissioner Joel Castone and Doing the Impossible. ANC Commissioner Joel Castone Doing the Impossible. Very inspirational story. Let me see if I can get him on one of our live streams here. This guy, matter of fact, I would say I would vote him as the It's My House Man of the Year. Guy was, currently incarcerated. And, I got everything back up. Let's get back to it without interruption.
Tonight, more than 1.3 million people are in prisons across America. A highly disproportionate number are Black and Latinx men. Criminal justice reformers say that their voices and the promise of their lives have been sidelined for far too long. But now one convicted felon in the nation's capital is fighting back from the inside, showing the power of rehabilitation and making political history in the process. Here's our Devin Dwyer.
From his cell block inside D.C. jail, Joel Castone is forging a new path to redemption.
One of my primary jobs is not only mentoring, but also being able to give you all wholesome content. Money coming in.
He teaches economics, leads Christian worship, and mentors dozens of fellow inmates in a program he helped create. And this spring, he turned to politics.
Who are your constituents? Who are the people that you're representing?
Yes, my constituents, first and foremost, the largest voting block of my constituents are incarcerated people.
After 27 years locked up for murder as a teenager, Castone launched a campaign for a seat on D.C.'s Advisory Neighborhood Commission and won, becoming the first person in the nation's capital to win election while incarcerated.
Has you ever voted before?
I never voted before.
So you were running for office and you had never even participated,
never participated
in the democratic process before.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't it amazing and how you can say, I want to be a part of something, but because the laws have prevented you, these barriers in place, and now these barriers are removed. So what we're doing here in D.C., we're actually setting the standard for the nation.
And you dressed the part.
I will be your biggest advocate.
His election is pushing the boundaries of voting rights after D.C. last year joined just Maine and Vermont in allowing felons to cast ballots and run for office from behind bars.
Most countries in the world, unlike the U.S., allow people to vote while they're incarcerated. In some countries, they actually bring the ballots to the prisons, and others they allow it by absentee. In other words, in most places, you don't lose your humanity, you don't lose your civil rights, social rights, political rights when you're incarcerated.
Commissioner Castone says his election shows the power of a second chance. In 1994, it was here in Southeast D.C. that as a teenager swept up in a culture of drugs and guns, Castone was arrested and later convicted in the shooting death of another young Black man.
I was heartbroken. I know that.
Delonte Uzzle, Castone's cousin and best friend, says the tragedy of that day shows just how unforgiving life on the streets could be.
You could get hurt walking to the store. If Joel was fighting, we had to fight. If I was fighting, they had to fight.
How have you noticed Joel change?
He's always been that guy since I can remember. Always like the best reading groups. Always been smart.
Were you shocked when he was elected as a commissioner in D.C.?
I was shocked, but it was a surprise. That's just always been him.
The family of the victim in Castone's case has given its full endorsement in a statement to ABC News saying, we believe in forgiveness and we hope Joel will do good work in the community.
As a teenager, I was once a drug dealer myself. I was once a gunman myself as a teenager. And I paid a huge penalty for that. That's my incarceration. But throughout my incarceration, the best advice my queen gave me was find God. And I sought God.
His queen is his mother, still a guiding light for Castone as he embarks on a two-year term to represent residents in one of the poorest parts of the city.
Maybe he's going to take that experience and share how he got through it, and so others won't have to. That would be good.
Some people are going to look at this with disdain, but a lot of people are going to think this is somebody who's really taking a step in the right direction.
His district includes D.C.'s jail, a nearby women's shelter, and this luxury apartment complex he's never seen.
How can you represent a group of people, a community, when you're cut off from a big segment of that community?
I would definitely answer that question by saying something no one expected, the global pandemic. A lot of meetings, a lot of engagement has taken place over Zoom. So now as an ANC commissioner, one of the things I do have access to is a computer.
So you're Zooming from inside this cell block?
I'm Zooming from the
you
inside.
You have an office.
I'm inside the office. Yes, I do. Yes.
You oversee everything from liquor license approval to sidewalk repair to public safety. Can you credibly advocate for public safety from in here?
I can, because those matters are matters that matters to my constituents. And so it behooves me to educate myself.
Joel Castone has probably more than any person in the country that I've heard of. He has the right to redeem himself and to have another chance.
Georgetown professor Mark Howard has taught Castone and encouraged him to run for commissioner. He calls him a model for the nation.
He's just so bright, outgoing, positive, inspirational to everyone around him. He represents not only the people in his district, but he represents all incarcerated people by showing what they're capable of.
Castone has taught himself Arabic and Mandarin, studies the Bible in French and Spanish, and has published a curriculum of books to help inmates learn the basics of investments and savings.
We want people on the inside thinking like citizens, and it seems oxymoronic, right? However, if we can get them thinking this way while they're on the inside, the overarching goal is that will be the mindset on the outside. So we're changing narrative.
Later this year, he expects to start his next chapter on parole, living in the district he'll represent as commissioner while chasing his passion for entrepreneurship.
Just taking the spotlight off me for a second, I think all lives matter, all voices matter, everyone's voice matters. And I think that when you look at a story like mine, it oftentimes we would just cast off individuals who are inside of cautious spaces and think that he or she does not have a value. I believe that my story demonstrates that, yes, we do have value.
Seeking redemption through politics and public service and hoping to restore faith in life after prison. For ABC News, I'm Devin Dwyer in Washington.
Giving a lot of people hope and purpose, our thanks to Devin for bringing us that story.
Hi, everyone. George Stephanopoulos here. Thanks for...
In the nation's seat of power, just a few miles from the White House and Capitol, a milestone for voting rights in America.
I noticed that, wait a minute, not only can we vote, we can also run for the office.
How many in the group this morning want to learn about the vet?
After 27 years behind bars, Joel Castone is seeking redemption through politics. The 44-year-old felon, convicted for murder as a teenager, became Washington, D.C.'s newest elected public servant this summer, winning a groundbreaking campaign for neighborhood commissioner on the city's southeast side.
It sounds great to have an official title, I must admit that. However, what it feels like is that now I have to deliver.
From an office behind bars, Castone will serve as an advisor to D.C. government and offer recommendations for improving city services.
Has you ever voted before?
I never voted before.
So you were running for office and you had never even participated in the democratic process before.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't it amazing and how you can say, I want to be a part of something, but because the laws have prevented you, these barriers in place, and now these barriers are removed. So what we're doing here in D.C., we're actually setting the standard for the nation.
Some of his roughly 2,000 constituents are fellow incarcerated residents in D.C. jail.
How many of y'all voted?
Many casting ballots in a local election that has pushed the boundaries of voting rights and racial justice. D.C. last year joined just Maine and Vermont as the only places in America that prisoners can vote.
When I actually put a check in that box and actually said that he won and this is the person I voted for, it like reaffirmed that, you know, I'm worthy to be back in society.
Less than 1% of the nation's estimated 1.8 million incarcerated residents has the right to cast a ballot from behind bars, setting the U.S. apart from many other democracies.
In other words, in most places, you don't lose your humanity, you don't lose your civil rights, social rights, political rights when you're incarcerated.
Georgetown professor Mark Howard, a leading advocate for felon voting rights, says it's also an issue of racial justice. One in 16 black American adults is disenfranchised because of a conviction, a rate 3.7 times higher than among non-blacks.
If you think about the broader context and history of the struggle for the right to vote in this country, incarcerated people was always a group that was left out of that progression.
He's now the first incarcerated American elected to office with votes from incarcerated peers.
How can you represent a group of people, a community, when you're cut off from a big segment of that community?
A lot of meetings, a lot of engagement has taken place over Zoom. So now as the ANC commissioner, one of the things I do have access to is a computer.
So you're Zooming from inside the cell block?
I'm Zooming from the
you
inside.
You have an office.
I'm inside the office. Yes, I do, yes.
His district includes D.C.'s jail, a nearby women's shelter, and this luxury apartment complex he's never seen.
You oversee everything from liquor license approvals to sidewalk repair to public safety. Can you credibly advocate for public safety from in here?
I can. I believe that my story, my campaign, is giving lens to individuals who may not have considered this as being a viable option to obtain public safety.
But enfranchisement of felons remains highly controversial.
It's called punishment. Punishment for their crime.
Many Republicans opposed House Democrats' sweeping election reform bill, H.R. 1, this spring, in part because it would have restored the vote to millions of ex-felons. While 21 states automatically return voting rights after release, 16 withhold the vote through periods of probation or parole, and 11 more suspend the vote indefinitely for some crimes.
Oftentimes, we would just cast off individuals who are inside of carceral spaces and think that he or she does not have a value. I believe that my story demonstrates that, yes, we do have value.
In 1994, it was here in Southeast D.C. that as a teenager swept up in a culture of drugs and guns, Castone was arrested and later convicted in the shooting death of another young black man.
As a teenager, I was once a drug dealer myself. I was once a gunman myself as a teenager, and I paid a huge penalty for that. That's my incarceration.
The family of the victim in Castone's case has given its full endorsement in a statement to ABC News saying, "We believe in forgiveness, and we hope Joel will do good work in the community." Castone expects to be paroled by the end of the year.
Joel Castone has probably more than any person in the country that I've heard of. He has the right to redeem himself and to have another chance.
Commissioner Castone already inspiring hope that his constituents can find redemption too.
Serving an 18-month sentence, and the thing I would like for Joel to do is continue to make the impossible possible,
because it helps young men to become better people.
He's inspired that we're more than inmates. You know, we're fathers, we're sons, we're brothers, and also we're politicians. Thank you, Joel.
Hi, everyone. George Stephanopoulos here. Thanks for checking out the ABC News YouTube channel.
Saturday morning, man.
Saturday morning.
All right, let's start our community conversation this morning.
I am the first elected official to hold a public seat as a current incarcerated individual. As an ANC commissioner, which is an advisory neighborhood commission, I serve as a liaison between my constituents and the government.
Many of us, we come from disinvested communities. What does that mean? Well, we know what the word invest means, to invest in a community. So if you disinvest, that means you're not investing in that community.
I come from Washington, D.C., come from Southeast, Ward 8. Growing up there, I had many examples. More of the examples were negative than positive. Ultimately led me in prison at the younger age of 18. I was sentenced to a life term of imprisonment. At this state, I have served 27 calendar years, and I'm on the brink of going back into society. My colleagues and I, we were putting together a podcast. We wanted to encourage the incarcerated resident here to vote.
Don't forget what you heard podcast, episode 1.
What's up, Slim?
I'm excited, brother.
What you excited about?
I got this ballot right here, man. They just official mail, official election mail.
Yeah, that's what's up, man. I've been thinking about this ever since I did register.
And researching that, I discovered that we can also run for the ANC seat.
To my fellow comrades, incarcerated residents here at D.C. Jail, my platform will be used to restore the dignity of incarcerated people, that we will no longer be judged by our worst mistake, and to establish equality for both the male and the female population that has often been overlooked inside this space. I will be your biggest advocate to make sure that your voice and your concerns are heard. Thank you for your time.
I cast my name in the ballot, and I was elected. It may be shocking for some, but many people who are behind walls are very active in politics. You find a crew of individuals who hover around the television set and watch CNN religiously, you know, faithfully. And so when you're watching this stuff and you begin to realize that these are where the policies are being made. This is how my community is being governed. And so when the District of Columbia, when they restored the vote and allowed incarcerated people to be able to vote, we said, oh, wow, now I have an opportunity to participate in something I have been watching from the sidelines. I really believe that being active civically is very important, especially for people who are incarcerated, because oftentimes it's stated those who are closer to the problems are closer to the solution. As the ANC commissioner, the District of Columbia government has to give my opinion great weight. It doesn't mean they have to follow it, but they have to acknowledge it and whether they decide to do or not to do the things that I'm advocating for my constituents.
So when you all kept saying the streets, and streets, let's substitute that word. We have marginalized communities. We have at-risk youth.
My win represents hope for everyone who are incarcerated, who have felt invisible, insignificant for far too long. It gives them hope in knowing that your voice, your thoughts, your ideas does matter.
That's my guy right there.
Making the case. Joel Castone is the first incarcerated person to hold public office in Washington, D.C., and he was kind enough to grant me an exclusive TV interview from the D.C. jail where he's currently being held. Joel, who was elected as an advisory neighborhood commissioner, has spent almost three decades in prison. He was convicted of murder at the age of 18, and the story of his life over the last 27 years behind bars is nothing short of remarkable. Tonight, we're airing my full interview with the man himself, Commissioner Castone. Now, you may be wondering how a person behind bars could be elected to public office. Well, it turns out in D.C., there isn't a specific ban or prohibition, but the mechanics of an incarcerated person getting elected are more complicated. The district where the D.C. jail is located hasn't had a representative since 2013 when it was first created, and that's because the district was made up of a jail and a women's homeless shelter. Incarcerated people couldn't vote, and shelter residents were, by definition, transient. All that changed last July was when D.C. joined states like Maine and Vermont in passing a bill allowing incarcerated people and people with felony convictions to vote. Suddenly, there were constituents in the district who could elect a representative, and that's how Joel's journey to public office started. An interesting footnote, there's now a luxury apartment building located in Joel's district. So not only will he be representing those who are incarcerated within the jail and those staying at the shelter, he'll also be representing those residents living in that new high-rise. When I met Joel, I wanted to understand his journey, starting with where he came from. Who was that young 18-year-old who was convicted of murder? What was he like to the 44-year-old who just made history and now holds an elected office?
I would say humble. There's no way I can be in this position. I have to give a strong shout out to all the returning citizens who have pounded pavement. These individuals have made our voices heard. They're doing remarkable jobs in the society, which convinced the council members here, D.C. council members, to pass this progressive law that allowed incarcerated residents to be able to vote in the first place and to run for public office. So I feel humble. I feel humble, and I would say this. I may be the first, but I will not be the last.
Look at you, talking like a politician already. All right, so before we get into your remarkable campaign and your future, I'd like to briefly talk about your past. You've been incarcerated for 26 years since you were 18. Why were you incarcerated?
I was incarcerated for a murder, a case that happened when I was 18 years of age. And since that time of my incarceration, as you had just already referenced, for 27 calendar years now, I turned 45 on the 13th of July this month here. And so from 18 to 45, which is a large span of time, is just I would say just coming outside of that dark space, if you will. There's no way you can survive the amount of time I've been incarcerated if you don't rely on God. So I'm the first to admit that my faith is what anchored me. And so my queen, which I call my mom, she was the person who told me to turn to God. And I turned to God, and God began to revive my spirit. And so now, not only am I using the term returning citizen, but as my pastor teaching me, I'm a redemptive citizen.
So tell me, who was Joel Castone at 18 years old? What was he like?
He was no different from most of the young guys that come from inner city communities, unfortunately. We understand that the root of all of mass incarceration is poverty, joblessness, poor education, all these things which created the monster we call mass incarceration, but also predates that when we go back to slavery and convict leasing and Jim Crowism and redlining, all these things, all these dynamics, and we don't really want to throw into the mix the war on drugs and what the crack epidemic did into our community. So growing up as a young man inside of Washington, D.C., which is the political capital of the world, I was always aware of politics, right? Even when I was a kid, I talk about this in my memoir, I ran for public council, to be a student council member, that is, to be a student council member when I was a kid. And so just wanted to be involved. And so that young person who I was, I like to say I was a clueless teen. Now I'm a commissioner, right? And so just coming from being a clueless teen who did not know his full.
Mr. Commissioner, if you don't mind me calling you Joel, right?
Yeah.
You earned that title, but I definitely want this to be more of an informal interview. I'm going to call you Joel. So you are now 44, about to be 45. If you had the opportunity to talk to your 18-year-old self, if you could give yourself at 18 any piece of advice, what would that be?
Don't be afraid to strive. Don't be afraid to be the best version that you can possibly be. Oftentimes, I think that in my personal story, as well as many members that come from my community, our narrative was shaped by our surroundings. And so I remember one time my family asked me, I actually went to a school that's outside of my district, and that school was the first time I was experiencing something that was other than what I formerly knew. That's just say drugs and violence and things of that nature. And I ran away from there. I ran away from it. I didn't even want to be a part of it because I felt like it was not me. Now, here I am, and all I want to be is in that type of stuff, right? And so not only do I want to be in that type of stuff, I want to go back to the young people that come from where I come from and let them say that you may have started here. You may have begun, you may have begun here, but you don't have to end it.
Now, before we get into your actual campaign run, tell me about some of the things that you've done while you've been incarcerated.
Yeah, since I've been incarcerated, I can say that outside of I actually had a spiritual awakening, the next thing I did was I began to pursue higher education, encouraged by an older gentleman who was my mentor, who encouraged me to get my GED. And once I got my GED, the light bulb went off. It was like, oh, my goodness. First, I didn't think I was going to get it. Then once I got it, I'm like this, wow, such a new world of possibilities opened up. And so the first thing I wanted to do was that my God brother, he encouraged me, he said, hey, if you want to take college classes, I'll pay for it. And so I began to look into what I want to do as far as college classes, and that led me down the track of finance. And I got into finance, but I didn't know finance is such a broad field. Business is a broad field. In fact, I just looked at business first. Then I went from business to finance. And once I got into finance, because I had a small nest egg saved up, and a lot of banks were asking my mom about what you want to do with this money here. My mom, hey, you got this money, what you want to do with it? I said, Mom, give me a second, right? Let me figure this out. And the stock market was booming at that time. And I got into the stock market. I remember Tavis Smiley. He had a little show on BET and demystifying the stock market. I used to watch the PBS station. They talk about the Wall Street Week with the late Louis Lukaiser. And I got into that. And I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the numbers. I fell in love with the fact that there were not enough people of color on that show. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, that inspired me. I said, you know what? I want to learn this. And I started reading every book that centered around finance. And like I said, I had a little money. I didn't have a lot, but I had a little money. And so I was trying to encourage my child's mom at the time to do some investing for me. And she said, you sound like you're talking Chinese. And so I had to break it down for her, right?
Yeah.
And in the process of me breaking it down, I started writing. And I shared my writings with my peers. My peers were like, who wrote that? And I wrote that. Like, you know that? Man. And that's when I realized I had a solid grasp on understanding the market. And that's what took me to where I'm at now. because I just became a financial geek. And I like saying that because I'm a geek. That's basically it. I'm a financial geek. I'm a self-published author. I wrote my book, Currency Catchers, that's available on Amazon. And I walk my readers in how to understand the markets, the beginner's version. And I wanted to get, I want to eliminate intergenerational poverty caused by the absence of asset ownership for people from disinvested communities.
Listen, you are light years ahead because, I mean, that's what we're just now getting into in financial literacy for our community is so important. All right, so to your campaign. You know, as a criminal defense attorney, I've represented people behind bars, and it isn't the kind of environment where hope lives, right? Instead, for the most part, it's where hope dies. Tell me what motivated you to run.
That's a power. The way you framed that question right there, you said it's not a place where hope lives, where hope dies. That is the truth. When I was sentenced to life in imprisonment at the age of 18, hope was snuffed out of me. There was no hope. Again, if it wasn't for my queen and told me to turn to God, I would have no hope right now.
Mm-hmm.
So in the process of me pursuing my faith in God, I realized that what we're doing currently here where I'm housed at D.C., shout out to D.C. D.C. got the game right. The director here, he has a progressive mindset. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to make these coffee spaces more equitable, more fair, especially for young people. Mm-hmm. Young people don't have a clue from right to left, right? And so hope for me, hope was my faith. And then as I said, once I have my faith, education is clear. And then that became my new makeup. I check in here. We have a check-in in the Wyoming community where we give rate our scales, our fitness from 1 to 10. And I intentionally rate in every day at $7.5 billion. I get an intention. So I want to raise the way we think.
Yes.
So I check in at $7.5 billion irregardless of what's going on in my life. It doesn't matter because mind is over matter. And so I do that to change the narrative and inject that type of sense of hope inside of my young people that I am mentoring inside the program. And so that's what took me out of my dark space. And once I grabbed on education, I didn't let it go.
So how was Joel able to run a successful campaign behind bars? Well, here's a clip from that part of the interview.
I realized that writing takes your voice outside your immediate space. And so a lot of the articles I wrote allow others to know who Joel Castone is. We have one narrative, but as representative of my constituents, we do not want to be defined by a single narrative.
We continue that conversation and more after the break. You're watching Making the Case. It's one thing to be eligible to run for public office, to be able to vote, but it's a whole other thing to run a campaign from behind bars. Remember, this had never been done before, so the logistics were, to say the least, challenging. In the end, though, five people ran, and Joel won 30% of the vote.
So tell us how you ran a campaign from inside of a jail cell.
I've been fortunate from a lot of my networks to be able to do a lot of writing. And so I realized that writing takes your voice outside your immediate space. And so a lot of the articles I wrote allow others to know who Joel Castone is. We have one narrative, but as representative of my constituents, we do not want to be defined by a single narrative. Mm-hmm. And so my narrative supersedes what led me to prison. And so that allowed me to gain or to meet other individuals who were invigorated and inspired by my story. To God be the glory, I would say that there. And then from that point on, I was doing a podcast with my colleagues here. And during the podcast, we were investigating the program, how we can be effective in the podcast. And I discovered that not only can we vote, but we can also run for office.
Yes.
I cast my name in the ballot. I cast my name in the ballot. I won. It was a hiccup. You know, I was disqualified for technicality around my address. And I was not despondent, even though I thought that it was a missed opportunity, because I feel as though my job is just to be a trailblazer. I'm a trailblazer. As I stated earlier, I'm the first, but I will not be the last. And so I ran again, and I was very inspired by the fact that not only were I running, there were other individuals who wanted to run.
Yes.
That's what it looks like, democracy in action.
So, Joel, I know that an organization called Neighbors for Justice really supported your campaign. Tell me about them.
Yeah, Neighbor for Justice. I met Judy Johnson, who was one of the founders of Neighbor for Justice. They actually were, she was very instrumental in my colleague, Anthony Petty, who was a young man, his middle-aged guy, said to my show, brother, was incarcerated since the age of 16, did 30 years straight, 16, 30 years straight. So Judy Johnson, Neighbor for Justice, was there for Anthony when he came home. And that means a lot to me. And so here we are in the wake of this nation going on a racial reckoning, looking at what went wrong in George Floyd and all the other people of color who were slain unjustly, and people want to get involved. And so here we have a group of people who want to get involved. They reached in and said, we see you as our neighbors, not as a single narrative, but as a neighbor, as a person. And so working with they suggested, they were also part of the network system I talked about. And there are so many people. I have to also acknowledge the Pivot Program, Georgetown University Pivot Program, through, led by the leadership of Mark Howard. And Mark Howard also was another remarkable person who allowed my voice to go beyond my four walls limitation, if you will. The thing I met with Mark would allow me to meet Kim Kardashian West. And I didn't meet the glam lady Kim Kardashian West. I didn't meet the billionaire Kim Kardashian West. I met the human being Kim, the homegirl, who came in the inside and said that she wanted to learn. So despite her status and all the mocking things she's doing in life, she came in vulnerable and humble and said, I want to learn. And so having the opportunity to meet these individuals allowed me to be able to get my voice out there. And frankly, what you all are doing for today, I'm very humble and thankful for you giving me your time, because I know that our time is our most valuable asset.
We're just so thankful that you've granted this interview to us, so thank you. So besides the support that you received on the outside, what was the support like on the inside, say from staff?
Yeah, I've been aggressive since I've been here. I don't like idle time. That's how you do the time. The time will do you. The old time is saying, you do the time will do you.
Yes.
So that, what that looks like for me is that I'm active in everything that goes down. If it's an education program, sign me up. Sign me up. I'm in everything. So what happened was by me doing that, my colleagues on the inside, my comrades, the men and the women, I'm going to ask you a question, Ray, too. A remarkable thing is happening. We have co-ed classes. You think of co-ed classes on the inside, like, wait a minute. Thank you going on. It's like bells start going off, right? But once again, with Georgetown University, taking classes with not only the males, but also the female incarcerated residents, which I said in my campaign that I want to make sure that I recognize the lives and the voices of the women, because I got an earful from the women. They feel unappreciated. They feel like their voices does not matter. They feel like they're not receiving the same fairness that their male counterparts are feeling. And so being in a class with these young ladies, or many of them, like in their 20s, and I'm in my mid-40s, I'm looking at the opportunity that I missed with being with my own daughter. My daughter was, unfortunately, she was born when I was incarcerated. I haven't spent a single day with my daughter. I haven't spent a single day outside of prison with my grandchildren, her children. And so my heart goes out for the women. My queen taught me how to respect the dignity of a woman. And so in that class and participating with the school newspaper, a number of the programs on the inside, everyone knows my name. And one of the things that we have inside of DCDOC is a tablet system, an education system where they have a lot of programs on the tablet. And so that internal communication got the word out. And so I think that probably put me a little bit above some of my competitors in the race, because I had so much content out there. But nonetheless, I say this again. I want to commend those men that ran. I wish it was some women that ran also. Hopefully next time it will be some women that run also. And as I stated, I may be the first, but I will not be the last.
So you just mentioned that you you had others that ran against you for other incarcerated people. What set your campaign apart from theirs?
As I stated, I think probably the content, right? I've been here for quite some time. I afforded me a lot of time here, and I haven't spent my time idle, as I already stated. I'm always active, engaging. I try to recognize humanity in all people. Part of my role is restoring the dignity of correction. I think that correctional people have got a bad rap. You know, sometimes we throw them on the bus, too. But they're here trying to do a job just like we're trying to do a job. So I like to look at how can we work harmoniously together. how can we bridge that gap? Because the patient and the physician must be on the same page. They can't be at odds, right? And so we are the patients because we're the inside, and they're the physicians because they're working, coming from the outside, then we have to have a harmonious relationship. And so doing that allowed me to meet so many people, and I think that may have given me a competitive edge, but I can say this here. I was not even worried about whether I won or lost. I was already a winner when I seen how many other people cast made in the ballot. That's why I ran. I wanted other people to exercise the power that comes with civic engagement. And that's what we need to do. We need to begin able to have civic engagement from the inside that can translate on the outside. If we can think like this on the inside, imagine what people will be once we transition and go home.
Absolutely. So that brings me to my next question. Last year in D.C., lawmakers voted to allow people with felony records who are still in prison to vote. Right now, there are so many restrictive voting laws in so many states. I mean, other than D.C., Vermont, and Maine, so many voting laws on the books that disenfranchise not only the incarcerated community but the returning citizens. Is that sort of the line of work you believe you'll get into once you're released?
Absolutely. Hands down. Because as I stated in the beginning of our interview here, if it wasn't for the work of my predecessors, I would not hold this office right now. And so what D.C. is doing, it has been the vanguard. If you look back in history, the nation's capital has been the vanguard of all the movements inside of the nation. And so I like to say what happens in this city sets the standard for the nation. So enfranchising the incarceration population is a vote for public safety. And so when we do that, again, if you have a person who was once a part of the problem, who was asking for opportunity to be a part of the solution, give that person opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they're doing here, even before I was elected into office, again, shout out to D.C. DOC, they gave us a seat at the table. And so giving me a seat at the table is saying, hey, let me hear from this guy who has 27 years of incarceration experience, who has been in 16 facilities, who has a proven track record, who has not succumbed to some of the ills that happens inside of the vices that happen inside of incarceration spaces. I don't have any disciplinary reports. I have not been using drugs. Any things that I'm not down those individuals who may have done so, but I'm only speaking about myself. I haven't done those things. And so now I'm the type of guy who you want at the table. And so we know now, even when we look at what's going on in our nation as relates to ESG and how now corporations can no longer make a file. The SEC, you know, I'm a financial geek, so give you this. But the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, have now made a law that when you're filing your, when these companies are doing their quarterly reports, they want to know what are you doing about ESG, environmental and social governance? How are you treating the social ills of the nation? They're being held accountable. And so they saying that we want you to go on the record and doing some good to the community at large. That's what needs to happen in the inside also, and this is what D.C. is doing.
Throughout our conversation, Joel emphasized that his running for office was not just about him. He wanted to inspire others who were incarcerated, the youth on the inside and on the outside who felt and continue to feel hopeless. As we head to break, here's a clip on how Joel hopes to continue inspiring others.
I'm only an investor. That's it. I'm just an investor being used by God's grace. And so if I can inspire anyone and not allow their past to define their future, to not allow that weight of what happened or what may be going on present in their lives to stop them from living out their full potential, then I've done my job.
More of our exclusive interview with the newly elected commissioner when we return.
In the end, the pictures may have said more than the words. Voting from jail, one of its residents who ran for office and won.
How do you feel in this moment?
Yeah, I've been saying this, Mike. I feel presidential.
Presidential, but now a commissioner. Commissioner Joel Castone will represent about 1,500 residents of the D.C. jail, the Harriet Tubman Women's Shelter, and new high-end apartments east of Capitol Hill.
So let's talk about getting down to business for your first ANC meeting. What are you going to bring up?
Well, I know the first thing I'm doing, I'm going to listen.
Listening to learn the ropes of government. But he says he's ready to talk about languishing mental health behind these walls and concerns from those in the women's shelter.
They feel like they're not receiving the same fair share of programming that is often geared towards the male population and not the female population.
What do you think that we're not hearing on the outside that needs to be heard inside these ANC meetings?
Yeah, I think the main thing is our humanity. Oftentimes when we are incarcerated, we lose the sense of a person's identity, that that individual is still a human being.
He says his voice deserves to be heard, not as a teenager convicted of murder in the 90s, but as the man he's chosen to be moving forward.
I can't live my life in a shadow. I can't live my life in reverse. I have to be forward thinking. And moving forward allows me to keep my eye on what's important.
Mike Valerio, WUSA 9.
Learned five languages. learned how to trade stocks, teaching people, educating people on the stock market. His jail cell, where he looked at it, he reframed the whole thing, is his office. And if you're on Blog Talk Radio, in the scrolling marquee, I've got, I think, one of the pictures I have in the scrolling marquee, all of them are him, Joel Castone. You see him, one of the pictures, he's in his cell, but it's his office. Zoom meeting, and all of this is legal. Like I say, now I'm glad he said he might be the first, but he won't be the last. And that's why I'm gonna try to track him down. He's done podcasts. I'm gonna see if I can get him on one of our live streams. Man, what a inspirational story. So it's like, I like to bring him, stories like him, because I'm looking at, you know what, if he can do positive things while incarcerated, then we have no excuse. Let's see. Now, if you guys got any trending topics, news stories, I was going to do some stuff out of Chicago. Matter of fact, originally I was going to do this whole podcast on what's happening up in Chicago. A police officer was fatally shot, I believe yesterday or the day before. Anyway, it's very recent. There's been a whole, I don't know if it's more than usual, but a lot going on in Chicago. But I ran across this Joel Castone thing. Inspiration for people that are not only incarcerated, but I would say even a bigger inspiration for people who have their full 100% liberty. In any event, if you got any topics that you want to discuss, 619-768-2945. Or if you want to, hey, Joel, man, he's got me pumped up. He's got me pumped up. Joel Castone.
today. They're looking for escapism.
Joel Castone is the first incarcerated person to hold public office in Washington, D.C., and he was kind enough to grant me an exclusive TV interview from the D.C. jail where he's currently being held. Joel, who was elected as an advisory neighborhood commissioner, has spent almost three decades in prison. He was convicted of murder at the age of 18, and the story of his life over the last 27 years behind bars is nothing short of remarkable. Tonight, we're airing my full interview with the man himself, Commissioner Castone. Now, you may be wondering how a person behind bars could be elected to public office. Well, it turns out in D.C., there isn't a specific ban or prohibition, but the mechanics of an incarcerated person getting elected are more complicated. The district where the D.C. jail is located hasn't had a representative since 2013 when it was first created, and that's because the district was made up of a jail and a women's homeless shelter. Incarcerated people couldn't vote, and shelter residents were, by definition, transient. All that changed last July was when D.C. joined states like Maine and Vermont in passing a bill allowing incarcerated people and people with felony convictions to vote. Suddenly, there were constituents in the district who could elect a representative, and that's how Joel's journey to public office started. An interesting footnote, there's now a luxury apartment building located in Joel's district. So not only will he be representing those who are incarcerated within the jail and those staying at the shelter, he'll also be representing those residents living in that new high-rise. When I met Joel, I wanted to understand his journey, starting with where he came from. Who was that young 18-year-old who was convicted of murder? What was he like to the 44-year-old who just made history and now holds an elected office?
I would say humble. There's no way I can be in this position. I had to give a strong shout out to all the returning citizens who have pounded pavement. These individuals have made our voices heard. They're doing remarkable jobs in the society, which convinced the council members here, D.C. council members, to pass this progressive law that allowed incarcerated residents to be able to vote in the first place and to run for public office. So I feel humble. I feel humble, and I would say this. I may be the first, but I will not be the last.
Look at you, talking like a politician already. All right, so before we get into your remarkable campaign and your future, I'd like to briefly talk about your past. You've been incarcerated for 26 years since you were 18. Why were you incarcerated?
I was incarcerated for a murder, a case that happened when I was 18 years of age. And since that time of my incarceration, as you had just already referenced, for 27 calendar years now, I turned 45 on the 13th of July this month here. And so from 18 to 45, which is a large span of time, it's just this, I would say, just coming outside of that dark space, if you will. There's no way you can survive the amount of time I've been incarcerated if you don't rely on God. So I'm the first to admit that my faith is what anchored me. And so my queen, which I call my mom, she was the person who told me to turn to God. And I turned to God, and God began to revive my spirit. And so now, not only am I using the term returning citizen, but as my pastor teaching me, I'm a redemptive citizen.
So tell me, who was Joel Castone at 18 years old? What was he like?
He was no different from most of the young guys that come from inner city communities, unfortunately. We understand that the root of all of mass incarceration is poverty, joblessness, poor education, all these things which created the monster we call mass incarceration, but also predates that when we go back to slavery, convict leasing, and Jim Crowism, and redlining, all these things, all these dynamics, and we don't really want to throw into the mix the war on drugs and what the crack epidemic did into our community. So growing up as a young man inside of Washington, D.C., which is the political capital of the world, I was always aware of politics, right? Even when I was a kid, I talk about this in my memoir, I ran for public council, to be a student council member, that is, to be a student council member when I was a kid. And so just wanted to be involved. And so that young person who I was, I like to say I was a clueless teen. Now I'm a commissioner, right? And so just coming from being a clueless teen who did not know his full.
Mr. Commissioner, if you don't mind me calling you Joel, right?
Yes.
You earned that title, but I definitely want this to be more of an informal interview. I'm going to call you Joel. So you are now 44, about to be 45. If you had the opportunity to talk to your 18-year-old self, if you could give yourself at 18 any piece of advice, what would that be?
Don't be afraid to strive. Don't be afraid to be the best version that you can possibly be. Oftentimes, I think that in my personal story, as well as many members that come from my community, our narrative was shaped by our surroundings. And so I remember one time my family asked me, I actually went to a school that's outside of my district, and that school was the first time I was experiencing something that was other than what I formerly knew. That's just say drugs and violence and things of that nature. And I ran away from there. I ran away from it. I didn't even want to be a part of it because I felt like it was not me. Now, here I am, and all I want to be is in that type of stuff, right? And so not only do I want to be in that type of stuff, I want to go back to the young people that come from where I come from and let them say that you may have started here. You may have begun. You may have begun here, but you don't have to end it.
Now, before we get into your actual campaign run, tell me about some of the things that you've done while you've been incarcerated.
Yeah, since I've been incarcerated, I can say that outside of I actually had a spiritual awakening, the next thing I did was I began to pursue higher education, encouraged by an older gentleman who was my mentor, who encouraged me to get my GED. And once I got my GED, the light bulb went off. It was like, oh, my goodness. First, I didn't think I was going to get it. Then once I got it, I'm like this, wow, such a new world of possibilities opened up. And so the first thing I wanted to do was that my God brother, he encouraged me, he said, hey, if you want to take college classes, I'll pay for it. And so I began to look into what I want to do as far as college classes, and that led me down the track of finance. And I got into finance, but I didn't know finance is such a broad field. Business is a broad field. In fact, I just looked at business first. Then I went from business to finance. And once I got into finance, because I had a small nest egg saved up, and a lot of banks were asking my mom about what do you want to do with this money here. My mom, hey, you got this money, what you want to do with it? I said, Mom, give me a second, right? Let me figure this out. And the stock market was booming at that time. And I got into the stock market. I remember Tavis Smiley. He was had a little show on BET and demystifying the stock market. I used to watch the PBS station. They talk about the Wall Street Week with the late Louis Lucas. And I got into that, and I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the numbers. I fell in love with the fact that there were not enough people of color on that show. Mm. And for some reason, that inspired me. I said, you know what? I want to learn this. And I started reading every, I started devouring every book that centered around finance. And I, like I said, I had a little money. I didn't have a lot, but I had a little money. And so I was trying to encourage my child's mom at the time to do some investing for me. And she said, you sound like you're talking Chinese. And so I had to break it down for her, right?
Yeah.
And in the process of me breaking it down, I started writing. And I shared my writings with my peers. My peers were like, who wrote that? And I wrote that. Like, you wrote that? Man. And that's when I realized I had a solid grasp and understanding of the market. And that's what took me to where I'm at now. Because I just became a financial geek. And I like saying that because I'm a geek. That's basically it. I'm a financial geek. I'm a self-published author. I wrote my book, Currency Catchers, that's available on Amazon. And I walk my readers in how to understand the markets, the beginner's version. And I want to eliminate intergenerational poverty caused by the absence of asset ownership for people from disinvested communities.
Listen, you are light years ahead because, I mean, that's what we're just now getting into, and financial literacy for our community is so important. All right, so to your campaign. You know, as a criminal defense attorney, I've represented people behind bars, and it isn't the kind of environment where hope lives, right? Instead, for the most part, it's where hope dies. Tell me what motivated you to run.
That's a power. The way you framed that question right there, you said it's not a place where hope lives, where hope dies. That is the truth. When I was sentenced to life in imprisonment at the age of 18, hope was snuffed out of me. There was no hope. Again, if it wasn't for my queen and told me to turn to God, I would have no hope right now.
Mm-hmm.
So in the process of me pursuing my faith in God, I realized that what we're doing currently here where I'm housed at D.C., shout out to D.C. D.C. got the game right. The director here, he has a progressive mindset. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to make these coffee spaces more equitable, more fair, especially for young people. Mm-hmm. Young people don't have a clue from right to left, right? And so hope for me, hope was my faith. And then, as I said, once I had my faith, education is clear. And then that became my new makeup. I check in here. We have a check-in in the Wyoming community where we give rate our scales, our fit in from 1 to 10. And I intentionally rate in every day at $7.5 billion. I need an attention. So I want to raise the way we think.
Yes.
So I check in at $7.5 billion, irregardless of what's going on in my life. It doesn't matter because mind is over matter. And so I do that to change the narrative and inject that type of sense of hope inside of my young people that I am mentoring inside the program. And so that's what took me out of my dark space. And once I grabbed on education, I didn't let it go.
So how was Joel able to run a successful campaign behind bars? Well, here's a clip from that part of the interview.
I realized that writing takes your voice outside your immediate space. And so a lot of the articles I wrote allow others to know who Joel Castone is. We have one narrative, but as represented by constituents, we do not want to be defined by a single narrative.
We continue that conversation and more after the break. You're watching Making the Case. It's one thing to be eligible to run for public office, to be able to vote, but it's a whole other thing to run a campaign from behind bars. Remember, this had never been done before, so the logistics were, to say the least, challenging. In the end, though, five people ran and Joel won 30% of the vote.
So tell us how you ran a campaign from inside of a jail cell.
I've been fortunate from a lot of my networks to be able to do a lot of writing. And so I realized that writing takes your voice outside your immediate space. And so a lot of the articles I wrote allow others to know who Joel Castone is. We have one narrative, but as represented by constituents, we do not want to be defined by a single narrative. And so my narrative supersedes what led me to prison. And so that allowed me to gain or to meet other individuals who were invigorated and inspired by my story. To God be the glory, I would say that did. And then from that point on, I was doing a podcast with my colleagues here. And during the podcast, we were investigating the program, how we can be effective in the podcast. And I discovered that not only can we run for office, excuse me, not only can we vote, but we can also run for office.
Yes.
I cast my name in the ballot. I won. It was a hiccup. You know, I was disqualified for technicality around my address, and I was not despondent, even though I thought that it was a missed opportunity, because I feel as though my job is just to be a trailblazer. I'm a trailblazer. As I stated earlier, I'm the first, but I will not be the last. And so I ran again, and I was very inspired by the fact that not only were I running, there were other individuals who wanted to run.
Yes.
That's what it looks like, democracy in action.
So, Joel, I know that an organization called Neighbors for Justice really supported your campaign. Tell me about them.
Yeah, Neighbors for Justice. I met Judy Johnson, who was one of the founders of Neighbors for Justice. They actually were – she was very instrumental in my colleague, Anthony Petty, who was a young man, his middle-aged guy, said to myself, but it was incarcerated since the age of 16, did 30 years straight, 16, 30 years straight. So Judy Johnson, Neighbors for Justice, was there for Anthony when he came home. And that means a lot to me. And so here we are in the wake of this nation going on a racial reckoning, looking at what went wrong in George Floyd and all the other people of color who were slain unjustly, and people want to get involved. And so here we have a group of people who want to get involved. They reached in, they said, we see you as our neighbors, not as a single narrative, but as a neighbor, as a person. And so working with they suggested they were also part of the network system I talked about. And there are so many people. I have to also acknowledge the Pivot Program, Georgetown University Pivot Program, through led by the leadership of Mark Howard. And Mark Howard also was another remarkable person who allowed my voice to go beyond my four walls limitations, if you will.
Yes.
The thing I met with Mark would allow me to meet Kim Kardashian West. And I didn't meet the glam lady, Kim Kardashian West. I didn't meet the billionaire, Kim Kardashian West. I met the human being, Kim, the homegirl, who came in the inside and said that she wanted to learn. So despite her status and all the mocking things she's doing, like, she came in, brought up and humble and said, I want to learn. And so having an opportunity to meet these individuals allowed me to be able to get my voice out there. And frankly, what you all are doing for today, I'm very humble and thankful for you giving me your time, because I know that our time is our most valuable asset.
We're just so thankful that you granted this interview to us, so thank you. So besides the support that you received on the outside, what was the support like on the inside, say from staff?
Yeah, I've been aggressive since I've been here. I don't like idle time. that's how you do the time. Time will do you. The old time is saying, you do the time will do you.
Yes.
So that, what that looks like for me is that I'm active in everything that goes down. If it's an education program, sign me up. Sign me up. I'm in everything. So what happened was, by me doing that, my colleagues on the inside, my comrades, the men and the women, I'm going to ask you questions way too. A remarkable thing is happening. We have co-ed classes. You think of co-ed classes in the inside, like, wait a minute.
Then yeah.
Thank you going on. It's like bells start going off, right? But once again, with Georgetown University, taking classes with not only the male, but also the female incarcerated residents, which I said in my campaign that I want to make sure that I recognize the lives and the voices of the women, because I got an earful from the women. They feel unappreciated. They feel like their voices does not matter. They feel like they're not receiving the same fairness that their male counterparts are feeling. And so being in class with these young ladies, or many of them, like in their 20s, and I'm in my mid-40s, I'm looking at the opportunity that I missed with being with my own daughter. My daughter was, unfortunately, she was born when I was incarcerated. I haven't spent a single day with my daughter. I haven't spent a single day outside of prison with my grandchildren, her children. And so my heart goes out for the women. My queen told me how to respect the dignity of a woman. And so in that class and participating with the school newspaper, a number of the programs on the inside, everyone knows my name. And one of the things that we have inside of DCDOC is the tablet system, the education system, where they have a lot of programs on the tablet. And so that internal communication got the word out. And so I think that probably put me a little bit above some of my competitors in the race because I had so much content out there. But nonetheless, I say this again. I want to commend those men that ran. I wish it was some women that ran also. Hopefully next time it will be some women that run also. And as I stated, I may be the first, but I will not be the last.
So you just mentioned that you you had others that ran against you for other incarcerated people. What set your campaign apart from theirs?
As I stated, I think probably the content, right? I've been here for quite some time. I afforded me a lot of time here, and I haven't spent my time idle, as I already stated. I'm always active, engaging. I try to recognize humanity in all people. Part of my role is restoring the dignity of correction. I think that correctional people have got a bad rap. You know, sometimes we throw them under the bus too. But they're here trying to do a job just like we're trying to do a job. So I like to look at how can we work harmoniously together. How can we bridge that gap? Because the patient and the physician must be on the same page. They can't be at odds, right? And so we are the patients because we're the inside, and they're the physicians because they're working, coming from the outside, then we have to be, have a harmonious relationship. And so doing that allowed me to meet so many people, and I think that may have gave me a competitive edge, but I can say this here. I was not even worried about whether I won or lost. I was already a winner when I seen how many other people cast their name in the ballot. That's why I ran. I wanted other people to exercise the power that comes with civic engagement. And that's what we need to do. We need to begin to have civic engagement from the inside that can translate on the outside. If we can think like this on the inside, imagine who people will be once we transition and go home.
Absolutely. So that brings me to my next question. Last year in D.C., lawmakers voted to allow people with felony records who are still in prison to vote. Right now, there are so many restrictive voting laws in so many states. I mean, other than D.C., Vermont, and Maine, so many voting laws on the books that disenfranchise not only the incarcerated community, but the returning citizens. Is that sort of the line of work you believe you'll get into once you're released?
Absolutely, hands down. Because as I stated in the beginning of our interview here, if it wasn't for the work of my predecessors, I would not hold this office right now. And so what DC is doing, it has been the vanguard. If you look back in history, the nation's capital has been the vanguard of all the movements inside of the nation. And so I like to say what happens in this city sets the standard for the nation. So enfranchising the incarceration population is a vote for public safety. And so when we do that, again, if you have a person who was once a part of the problem, who was asking for opportunity to be a part of the solution, give that person opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they're doing here, even before I was elected into his office, again, shout out to DCDOC, they gave us a seat at the table. And so giving me a seat at the table is saying, hey, let me hear from this guy who has 27 years of incarceration experience, who has been in 16 facilities, who has a proven track record, who has not succumbed to some of the ills that happens inside of the vices that happen inside of incarceration spaces. I don't have any disciplinary reports. I have not been using drugs, anything that I'm not down to those individuals who may have done so, but I'm only speaking about myself. I haven't done those things. And so now I'm the type of guy who you want at the table. And so we know now, even when we look at what's going on in our nation as late to ESG and how now corporations can no longer make a file. The SEC, you know, financial geeks, so forgive me this. But the SEC, the Security Exchange Commission, have now made a law that when you're filing your, when these companies are doing their quarterly reports, they want to know what are you doing about ESG, environmental and social governance? How are you treating the social ills of the nation? They're being held accountable. And so they saying that we want you to go on the record and doing some good to the community at large. That's what needs to happen in the inside also, and this is what D.C. is doing.
Throughout our conversation, Joel emphasized that his running for office was not just about him. He wanted to inspire others who were incarcerated, the youth on the inside and on the outside who felt and continue to feel hopeless. As we head to break, here's a clip on how Joel hopes to continue inspiring others.
I'm only an investor. That's it. I'm just a vessel being used by God's grace. And so if I can inspire anyone to not allow their past to define their future, to not allow that weight of what happened or what may be going on present in their life to stop them from living out their full potential, then I've done my job.
More of our exclusive interview with the newly elected commissioner when we return.
Say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back out the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, "What y'all finna do?" He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family going to live in there? Is they going to... I'm going to get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
Today's podcast has been on, it was titled ANC Commissioner Joel Castone Doing the Impossible. Man's an inmate in the D.C. jail system and learned about politics, how to run for office, and got elected to a political office in D.C. He's got constituents, very inspirational story. Now, in trending news, Governor Cuomo of New York State just a few minutes ago resigned. The resignation will be effective in 14 days. So, let's see, we're trying to get that for you. But he just, said he will be resigning effective in 14 days. And New York State, and I guess that's, you know, it's time for his team to bring up to speed. The lieutenant governor, who is a female woman. So, man, if you guys got any thoughts on that, give us a call, 619-768-2945. New York State's got a that can be a rough state. Man, I tell you, I got to watch what I say because I don't want to get in trouble. But several ladies came forward, and the Attorney General for the state of New York is a woman. And, man, she's got a pair of knockers on her. I think she sued the New York City police and probably de Blasio, too. And didn't kowtow to the governor. And what's she? I mean, if you guys out there listening, what's your take on it? Let's see. We got about 5 minutes left, so let's take a short entertainment break. If you guys want to chime in on this one, we might pick it up tomorrow.
How it go?
We got one out of two of the motherfuckers, you know?
You mean you motherfuckers come strolling in here all walking tall and shit?
Look, yeah, man, I'm saying, man, we was blazing on them dudes, man, you know what I'm saying? Just got in the heat, man. We was blazing, though. It was late.
All right. Relax, man. I already heard. Go sit down. I'm not tweaking behind none of this. That's one less motherfucker that's breathing than was yesterday. You know what I'm saying? So we all good. But I'm surprised at you, though, man. Shit didn't get by you back when.
Well, my man's fault, man. I unloaded on the younger too soon, man. Gave him enough room to buck and run, man. I fucked that shit up myself, you know.
Hold on. On me. I had that kid in my sights, close enough to take off his Kango and half his dome with it. Couldn't squeeze the trigger. Couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
Wasn't in me, I guess. You know, whatever it is in you, that let you flow like you flow and do that thing, it ain't in me no more.
All right. So you done soldiering, but you ain't done. Could use you for what you got in your head. We're going to put you on a corner. You could be inside.
Oh, man. I ain't making myself clear. The game ain't in me no more. None of it.
But you ain't done shit else. You know what I'm saying? So what you gonna do?
I don't know. But it can't be this.
All right, then. We straight.
B, he was a man in his time, you know?
Yeah. He a man today. He a man.